I'll set it all straight, for it was impossible for me not to come to you this evening, Natasha.
What note?
Asked Natasha.
He went to my rooms and didn't find me. Of course, he pitched into me roundly in the letter he left for me for not having been to see you. And he's quite right. It was yesterday.
Natasha glanced at me.
But if you had time to be with Katerina Fyodorovna from morning till night,
Prince Malkovsky began.
I know what you'll say,
Alyosha interrupted.
If I could be at Katya's, I ought to have had twice as much reason to be here. I quite agree with you, and will add for myself not twice as much reason, but a million times as much. But to begin with, there are strange, unexpected events in life which upset everything and turn it topsy-turvy, and it's just things of that sort that have been happening to me. I tell you, I've become an utterly different person during the last days. New all over to the tips of my fingers. So they must have been important events.
Oh, dear me, but what has happened to you? Don't keep us in suspense, please,
cried Natasha, smiling at Alyosha's heat. He really was rather absurd. He talked very fast. His words rushed out pell-mell in a quick, continual patter. He was longing to tell us everything, to speak, to talk. But as he talked, he still held Natasha's hand and continually raised it to his lips as though he could never kiss it enough.
That's the whole point. What has happened to me?
Alyosha went on.
Ah, my friends, the things I've been seeing and doing, the people I've got to know. To begin with, Katya. Such a perfect creature. I didn't know her a bit, not a bit till now. Even the other day, that Tuesday, when I talked about her, do you remember, Natasha, with such enthusiasm, even then I hardly knew her a bit. She hasn't shown her real self to me till now. But now we've got to know each other thoroughly. We call each other Katya and Alyosha. But I'll begin at the beginning. To begin with, Natasha, if only you could hear all that she said to me when I spoke to her about you the other day. Wednesday it was, and told her all that had happened here. And by the way, I remember how stupid I was when I came to see you on Wednesday. You greeted me with enthusiasm. You were full of our new position. You wanted to talk to me about it all. You were sad, and at the same time you were full of mischief and playing with me, while I was trying to be dignified. Oh, fool, fool that I was! Would you believe it, I was longing to show off, to boast that I was soon to be a husband, a dignified person, and to think of my showing off to you. Ah, how you must have laughed at me, and how I deserved your ridicule!
Prince Valkovsky sat in silence, looking with a sort of triumphantly ironical smile at Alyosha. He seemed to be glad that his son was showing himself so flighty and even ridiculous. I watched him carefully all that evening, and came to the conclusion that he was not at all fond of his son, though he was always talking of his warm, fatherly devotion to him.
From you I went to Katya,
Alyosha rattled on.
I've told you already that it was only that morning we got to know each other thoroughly, and it's queer how it happened. I don't remember how it was. Some warm words, some feelings, thoughts frankly uttered, and we were friends for ever. You must know her, you must, Natasha. How she talked to me, how she interpreted you to me, how she explained to me what a treasure you are. By degrees she made me understand all her ideas, all her views of life. She's such an earnest, such an enthusiastic girl. She talked of duty, of our mission in life, of how we all ought to serve humanity, and, as we thoroughly agreed, after 5 or 6 hours of conversation, we ended by swearing eternal friendship, and that we would work together all our lives.
Work at what?
Asked his father in astonishment.
I'm so changed, father, that all this must surprise you. I know all your objections beforehand.
Alyosha responded triumphantly.
You are all practical people. You have so many grave, severe principles that are out of date. You look with mistrust, with hostility, with derision at everything new, everything young and fresh. But I'm not the same now as you knew me a few days ago. I'm a different man. I look everything and everyone in the world boldly in the face. If I know that my conviction is right, I will follow it up to its utmost limit. And if I'm not turned aside from my path, I'm an honest man. That's enough for me. You can say what you like after that. I believe in myself.
Oh-ho,
said the prince jeeringly. Natasha looked round at us uneasily. She was afraid for Alyosha. It often happened that he showed to great disadvantage in conversation, and she knew it. She did not want Alyosha to make himself ridiculous before us, and especially before his father.
What are you saying, Alyosha? I suppose it's some sort of philosophy, she said. Someone's been lecturing you. You'd much better tell us what you've been doing.
But I am telling you,
cried Alyosha.
You see, Katya has two distant relations, cousins of some sort, called Levinka and Barinka. One's a student, the other's simply a young man. She's on friendly terms with them, and they're simply extraordinary men. They hardly ever go to the Countess's on principle. When Katya and I talked of the destiny of man, of our mission in life and all that, she mentioned them to me, and gave me a note to them at once. I flew immediately to make their acquaintance. We became close friends that very evening. There were about 12 fellows of different sorts there. Students, officers, artists. There was one author. They all know you, Ivan Petrovitch. That is, they've read your books and expect great things of you in the future. They told me so themselves. I told them I knew you and promised to introduce them to you. They all received me with open arms like a brother. I told them straight off that I should soon be a married man, so they received me as a married man. They live on the 5th story right under the roof. They meet as often as they can, chiefly on Wednesdays at Levinka's and Barinka's. They're all fresh young people filled with ardent love for all humanity. We all talked of our present, of our future, of science and literature, and talked so well, so frankly and simply. There's a high school boy who comes too. You should see how they behave to one another, how generous they are. I've never seen men like them before. Where have I been all this time? What have I seen? What ideas have I grown up in? You're the only one, Natasha, who has ever told me anything of this sort. Ah, Natasha, you simply must get to know them. Katya knows them already. They speak of her almost with reverence. And Katya's told Levinka and Barinka already that when she comes into her property, she'll subscribe 1,000,000 to the common cause at once.
And I suppose Levinka and Barinka and all their crew will be the trustees for that 1,000,000,
Prince Valkosky asked.
That's false, that's false. It's a shame to talk like that, Father.
Alyosha cried with heat.
I suspect what you're thinking. We certainly have talked about that 1,000,000, and spent a long time discussing how to use it. We decided at last on public enlightenment before everything else.
Yes, I see that I did not quite know Katerina Fyodorovna. Certainly,
Prince Valkosky observed, as it were to himself, still with the same mocking smile.
I was prepared for many things from her, but this...
Why this?
Alyosha broke in.
Why do you think it so odd? Because it goes somewhat beyond your established routine? Because no one has subscribed 1,000,000 before, and she subscribes it? What of it? What if she doesn't want to live at the expense of others, for living on those millions means living at the expense of others? I've only just found that out. She wants to be of service to her country and all, and to give her might to the common cause. We used to read of that might in our copybooks, and when that might means 1,000,000, you think there's something wrong about it. And what does it all rest on, this common sense that's so much praised and that I believed in so? Why do you look at me like that, Father? As though you were looking at a buffoon, a fool. What does it matter, my being a fool? Natasha, you should have heard what Katya said about that. It's not the brains that matter most, but that which guides them. The character, the heart, generous qualities, progressive ideas. But better still, Bezmygin has a saying about that that's full of genius. Bezmygin is a friend of Levinka's and Barinka's, and between ourselves he is a man of brains and a real leader of genius. Only yesterday he said in conversation, "The fool who recognizes that he is a fool is no longer a fool." How true that is! One hears utterances like that from him every minute. He positively scatters truths.
A sign of genius, certainly, observed Prince Valkosky.
You do nothing but laugh. But I've never heard anything like that from you, and I've never heard anything like it from any of your friends either. On the contrary, in your circle you seem to be hiding all this, to be grovelling on the ground, so that all figures, all noses, may follow precisely certain measurements, certain rules, as though that were possible, as though that were not 1,000 times more impossible than what we talk about and what we think. And yet they call us utopian. You should have heard what they said to me yesterday.
Well, but what is it you talk and think about? Tell us, Alyosha. I can't quite understand yet,
said Natasha.
Of everything in general that leads up to progress, to humanity, to love, it's all in relation to contemporary questions. We talk about the need of a free press, of the reforms that are beginning, of the love of humanity, of the leaders of today. We criticize them and read them. But above all, we've promised to be perfectly open with one another, and to tell everything about ourselves, plainly, openly, without hesitation. Nothing but openness and straightforwardness can attain our object. That's what Bezmygin is striving most for. I told Katya about that, and she is in complete sympathy with Bezmygin. And so all of us, under Bezmygin's leadership, have promised to act honestly and straightforwardly all our lives, and not to be disconcerted in any way, not to be ashamed of our enthusiasm, our fervour, our mistakes, and to go straight forward whatever may be said of us, and however we may be judged. If you want to be respected by others, the great thing is to respect yourself. Only by that, only by self-respect, will you compel others to respect you. That's what Besmegin says, and Katya agrees with him entirely. We're agreeing now upon our convictions in general, and have resolved to pursue the study of ourselves severally, and when we meet, to explain ourselves to each other.
What a string of nonsense, cried Prince Valkoski uneasily. And who is this Besmegin? No, it can't be left like this.
What can't be left?
Cried Alyosha.
Listen, father, why I say all this before you. It's because I want and hope to bring you too into our circle. I've pledged myself in your name already. You laugh. Well, I knew you'd laugh. But hear me out. You are kind and generous. You'll understand. You don't know. You've never seen these people. You haven't heard them. Supposing you have heard of all this and have studied it all, you are horribly learned, yet you haven't seen them themselves, have not been in their house, and so how can you judge of them correctly? You only imagine that you know them. You be with them, listen to them, and then I'll give you my word you'll be one of us. Above all, I want to use every means I can to rescue you from ruin in the circle to which you have so attached yourself, and so save you from your convictions.
Prince Valkoski listened to this sally in silence with a malignant sneer. There was malice in his face. Natasha was watching him with unconcealed repulsion. He saw it, but pretended not to notice it. But as soon as Alyosha had finished, his father broke into a peal of laughter. He fell back in his chair as though he could not control himself. But the laughter was certainly not genuine. He was quite unmistakably laughing simply to wound and to humiliate his son as deeply as possible. Alyosha was certainly mortified. His whole face betrayed intense sadness. But he waited patiently until his father's merriment was over.
Father,
he began mournfully,
why are you laughing at me? I have come to you frankly and openly. If, in your opinion, what I say is silly, teach me better and don't laugh at me. And what do you find to laugh at? At what is for me good and holy now? Why, suppose I'm in error, suppose this is all wrong, mistaken, suppose I am a little fool, as you've called me several times. If I'm making a mistake, I'm sincere and honest in it. I've done nothing ignoble. I'm enthusiastic over lofty ideas. They may be mistaken, but what they rest upon is holy. I've told you that you and all your friends have never yet said anything to me that could guide me or influence me. Refute them. Tell me something better than they have said, and I will follow you, but do not laugh at me, for that grieves me very much.
Alyosha pronounced these words with extreme sincerity and a sort of severe dignity. Natasha watched him sympathetically. The prince heard his son with genuine amazement, and instantly changed his tone.
I did not mean to grieve you, my dear,
he answered.
On the contrary, I am sorry for you. You are preparing to take such a step in life that it is only seemly for you to leave off being such a feather-headed boy. That's what is in my mind. I could not help laughing, and had no wish to hurt your feelings.
Why was it that I thought so?
Said Alyosha with bitter feeling.
Why has it seemed for a long time past that you look at me as though you were antagonistic to me, with cold mockery, not like a father? Why is it I feel that if I were in your place, I should not laugh so offensively as you do at me? Listen, let us speak openly to one another, at once and for ever, that there may be no further misunderstanding. And I want to tell you the whole truth. I thought when I came here that there was some misunderstanding. It was not like this that I expected to meet you all together. Am I right? If I am, wouldn't it be better for each of us to say openly what he feels? How much evil may be averted by openness?
Speak, speak, Alyosha,
said Prince Valkoski.
What you propose is very sensible. Perhaps you ought to have begun with that,
he added, glancing at Natasha.
Don't be angry with my perfect frankness,
began Alyosha.
You desire it and call for it yourself. Listen, you have agreed to my marriage with Natasha. You've made us happy by doing so, and for the sake of it you have overcome your own feelings. You have been magnanimous, and we have all appreciated your generosity. But why is it now that with a sort of glee you keep hinting that I'm a ridiculous boy and am not fit to be a husband? What's more, you seem to want to humiliate me and make me ridiculous, and even contemptible in Natasha's eyes. You are always delighted when you can make me look absurd. I've noticed that before now for a long time past, as though you were trying for some reason to show us that our marriage is absurd and foolish, and that we are not fitted for one another. It's really as though you didn't believe yourself in what you designed for us, as though you look upon it all as a joke, as an absurd fancy, as a comic farce. I don't think so, only from what you've said today. That very evening, that Tuesday, when I came back to you from here, I heard some strange expressions from you which surprised and hurt me. And on Wednesday, too, as you were going away, you made some allusions to our present position, and spoke of her not slightingly, quite the contrary, but yet not as I would like to hear you speak, somehow too lightly, without affection, without the respect for her. It's difficult to describe, but the tone was clear. One feels it in one's heart. Tell me that I'm mistaken. Reassure me, comfort me, and her, for you've wounded her, too. I guessed that from the first moment I came in.
Alyosha said this with warmth and resolution. Natasha listened to him with a certain triumph, and her face glowing with excitement, she said as though to herself once or twice during his speech,
"Yes, yes, that's true."
Prince Valkovsky was taken aback.
"My dear boy," he answered, "of course I can't remember everything I've said to you, but it's very strange you should have taken my words in that way. I'm quite ready to reassure you in every way I can. If I laughed just now, that was quite natural. I tell you that I tried to hide under a laugh my bitter feeling. When I imagine that you are about to be a husband, it seems to me now so utterly incredible, so absurd, excuse my saying so, even ludicrous. You reproach me for that laugh, but I tell you that it is all your doing. I am to blame, too. Perhaps I haven't been looking after you enough of late, and so it's only this evening that I have found out of what you are capable. Now I tremble when I think of your future with Natalia Nikolaevna. I have been in too great a hurry. I see that there is a great disparity between you. Love always passes, but incompatibility remains forever. I am not speaking now of your fate, but if your intentions are honest, do consider. You will ruin Natalia Nikolaevna as well as yourself. You certainly will. Here you've been talking for an hour of love for humanity, of the loftiness of your convictions, of the noble people you've made friends with. But ask Ivan Petrovich what I said to him just now as we climbed up that nasty staircase to the fourth story and were standing at the door, thanking God that our lives and limbs were safe. Do you know the feelings that came into my mind in spite of myself? I was surprised that with your love for Natalia Nikolaevna you could bear to let her live in such a flat. How is it you haven't realized that, if you have no means, if you are not in a position to do your duty, you have no right to be a husband, you have no right to undertake any responsibilities? Love alone is a small matter. Love shows itself in deeds, but your motto is live with me if you have to suffer with me. That's not humane, you know, not honorable, to talk of love for all humanity, to go into raptures over the problems of the universe, and at the same time to sin against love without noticing it. It's incomprehensible. Don't interrupt me, Natalia Nikolaevna. Let me finish. I feel it too bitterly. I must speak out. You've been telling us, Alyosha, that during these last days you've been attracted by everything that's honorable, fine, and noble, and you have reproached me that among my friends there are no such attractions, nothing but cold common sense. Only imagine, to be attracted by everything lofty and fine, and, after what happened here on Tuesday, to neglect for 4 whole days the woman who, one would have thought, must be more precious to you than anything on earth. You positively confess that you argued with Katerina Fyodorovna that Natalia Nikolaevna is so generous and loves you so much that she will forgive you your behavior. But what right have you to reckon on such forgiveness and make bets about it? And is it possible you haven't once reflected what distress, what bitter feelings, what doubts, what suspicions you've been inflicting on Natalia Nikolaevna all this time? Do you think that because you've been fascinated there by new ideas, you had the right to neglect your first duty? Forgive me, Natalia Nikolaevna, for breaking my word. But the present position is more important than any promise. You will realize that yourself. Do you know, Alyosha, that I found Natalia Nikolaevna in such agonies of distress that it was plain what a hell you had made of these 4 days for her, which should, one would have thought, have been the happiest in her life? Such conduct on one side, and on the other, words, words, words. Am I not right? And you can blame me when it's entirely your own fault.
Prince Valkovsky finished. He was really carried away by his own eloquence, and could not conceal his triumph from us. When Alyosha heard of Natasha's distress, he looked at her with painful anxiety, but Natasha had already come to a decision.
"Never mind, Alyosha, don't be unhappy," she said. "Others are more to blame than you. Sit down and listen to what I have to say to your father. It's time to make an end of it.
Explain yourself, Natalia Nikolaevna,
cried the prince.
I beg you most earnestly. For the last 2 hours I have been listening to these mysterious hints. It is becoming intolerable, and I must admit I didn't expect such a welcome here.
Perhaps because you expected so to fascinate us with words that we should not notice your secret intentions. What is there to explain to you? You know it all, and understand it all yourself. Alyosha is right. Your first desire is to separate us. You knew beforehand, almost by heart, everything that would happen here, after last Tuesday, and you were reckoning on it all. I have told you already that you don't take me seriously, nor the marriage you have planned. You are making fun of us, you are playing, and you have your own objects. Your game is a safe one. Alyosha was right when he reproached you for looking on all this as a farce. You ought, on the contrary, to be delighted and not scold Alyosha, for without knowing anything about it, he has done all that you expected of him, and perhaps even more.
I was petrified with astonishment. I had expected some catastrophe that evening. But I was utterly astounded at Natasha's ruthless, plain speaking and her frankly contemptuous tone. Then she really must know something, I thought, and has irrevocably determined upon a rupture. Perhaps she had been impatiently expecting the prince in order to tell him everything to his face. Prince Valkovsky turned a little pale. Alyosha's face betrayed naive alarm and agonizing expectation.
"Think what you have just accused me of," cried the prince, "and consider your words a little. I can make nothing of it."
"Ah, so you don't care to understand at a word," said Natasha. "Even he, even Alyosha, understood you as I did, and we are not in any agreement about it. We have not even seen each other. He, too, fancied that you were playing an ignoble and insulting game with us, and he loves you and believes in you as though you were a god. You haven't thought it necessary to be cautious and hypocritical enough with him. You reckoned that he would not see through you. But he has a tender, sensitive, impressionable heart, and your words, your tone, as he says, have left a trace in his heart."
"I don't understand a word of it, not a word of it,"
repeated Prince Valkovsky, turning to me with an air of the utmost perplexity, as though he were calling me to witness. He was hot and angry.
"You are suspicious, you are agitated,"
he went on, addressing her.
"The fact is, you are jealous of Katerina Fyodorovna, and so you're ready to find fault with everyone, and me especially. And allow me to say, you give one a strange idea of your character. I am not accustomed to such scenes. I would not remain here another moment if it were not for my son's interests. I am still waiting. Will you condescend to explain?"
"So you still persist and will not understand, though you know all this by heart. Do you really want me to speak out?"
"That is all I am anxious for."
"Very well, then. Listen,"
cried Natasha, her eyes flashing with anger.
"I'll tell you everything. Everything."
Chapter 3. She got up and began to speak, standing, unconscious of doing so in her excitement. After listening for a time, Prince Valkovsky too stood up. The whole scene became quite solemn.
"Remember your own words on Tuesday,"
Natasha began.
"You said you wanted money, to follow the beaten track, importance in the world. Do you remember?"
"I remember."
"Well, to gain that money, to win all that success which was slipping out of your hands, you came here on Tuesday and made up this match, calculating that this practical joke would help you to capture what was eluding you."
"Natasha," I cried, "think what you're saying."
"Joke? Calculating?"
repeated the prince with an air of insulted dignity. Alyosha sat crushed with grief and gazed scarcely comprehending.
"Yes, yes, don't stop me. I have sworn to speak out,"
Natasha went on, irritated.
"Remember, Alyosha was not obeying you. For 6 whole months you had been doing your utmost to draw him away from me. He held out against you. And at last the time came when you could not afford to lose a moment. If you let it pass, the heiress, the money, above all the money, the 3 millions of dowry, would slip through your fingers. Only one course was left you, to make Alyosha love the girl you destined for him. You thought that if he fell in love with her, he would abandon me."
"Natasha, Natasha,"
Alyosha cried in distress.
"What are you saying?"
"And you have acted accordingly,"
she went on, not heeding Alyosha's exclamation.
"But it was the same old story again. Everything might have gone well, but I was in the way again. There was only one thing to give you hope. A man of your cunning and experience could not help seeing even then that Alyosha seemed at times weary of his old attachment. You could not fail to notice that he was beginning to neglect me, to be bored, to stay away for 5 days at a time. You thought he might get tired of it altogether and give me up, when suddenly on Tuesday Alyosha's decided action came as a shock to you. What were you to do?
Excuse me,
cried Prince Valkovsky.
On the contrary, that fact...
I say,
Natasha went on emphatically,
you asked yourself that evening what you were to do, and resolved to sanction his marrying me not in reality, but only in words, simply to soothe him. The date of the wedding could be deferred, you thought, indefinitely, and meanwhile the new feeling was growing. You saw that. And on the growth of this new love you rested all your hopes.
Novels, novels,
the prince pronounced in an undertone, as though speaking to himself.
Solitude, breeding, and novel reading.
Yes, on this new love you rested everything,
Natasha repeated, without listening or attending to his words, more and more carried away in a fever of excitement.
And the chances in favour of this new love. It had begun before he knew all the girl's perfections. At the very moment when he disclosed to her that evening that he could not love her, that duty and another love forbade it, the girl suddenly displayed such nobility of character, such sympathy for him and for her rival, such spontaneous forgiveness, that though he had believed in her beauty, he only realized then how splendid she was. When he came to me, he talked of nothing but her. She had made such an impression upon him. Yes, he was bound next day to feel an irresistible impulse to see this noble being again, if only from gratitude. And indeed, why shouldn't he go to her? His old love was not in distress now. Her future was secured. His whole life was to be given up to her, while the other would have only a minute. And how ungrateful Natasha would be if she were jealous even of that minute. And so, without noticing it, he robs his Natasha not of a minute, but of 1 day, 2 days, three. And meantime, in those 3 days, the girl shows herself to him in a new and quite unexpected light. She is so noble, so enthusiastic, and at the same time such a naive child, and in fact so like himself in character. They vow eternal friendship and brotherhood. They wish never to be parted. In 5 or 6 hours of conversation, his soul is open to new sensations, and his whole heart is won. The time will come at last, you reckon, when he will compare his old feeling with his new, fresh sensations. There everything is familiar, and the same as usual. There it's all serious and exacting. There he finds jealousy and reproaches. There he finds tears. Or if there is lightness and playfulness, he is treated like a child, not an equal. But worst of all, it's all familiar, the same as ever.
Tears and a spasm of bitterness choked her, but Natasha controlled herself for a minute longer.
And what besides? Why, time. The wedding with Natasha is not fixed yet, you think. There's plenty of time, and all will change. And then your words, hints, arguments, eloquence. You may even be able to trump up something against that troublesome Natasha. You may succeed in putting her in an unfavourable light, and there's no telling how it will be done, but the victory is yours. Alyosha, don't blame me, my dear. Don't say that I don't understand your love and don't appreciate it. I know you love me even now, and that perhaps at this moment you don't understand what I complain of. I know I've done very wrong to say all this, but what am I to do, understanding all this and loving you more and more, simply madly?
She hid her face in her hands, fell back in her chair, and sobbed like a child. Alyosha rushed to her with a loud exclamation. He could never see her crying without crying too. Her sobs were, I think, of great service to the prince. Natasha's vehemence during this long explanation, the violence of her attack on him, which he was bound, if only from decorum, to resent, all this might be set down to an outburst of insane jealousy, to wounded love, even to illness. It was positively appropriate to show sympathy.
Calm yourself. Don't distress yourself, Natalia Nikolaevna,
Prince Valkovsky encouraged her.
This is frenzy, imagination, the fruits of solitude. You have been so exasperated by his thoughtless behaviour. It is only thoughtlessness on his part, you know. The most important fact on which you lay so much stress, what happened on Tuesday, ought rather to prove to you the depth of his love for you, while you have been imagining on the contrary.
Oh, don't speak to me, don't torture me, even now,
cried Natasha, weeping bitterly.
My heart has told me everything, has told me long ago. Do you suppose I don't understand that our old love is over, here in this room, alone? When he left me, forgot me, I have been through everything, thought over everything. What else have I to do? I don't blame you, Alyosha. Why are you deceiving me? Do you suppose I haven't tried to deceive myself? Oh, how often, how often! Haven't I listened to every tone of his voice? Haven't I learnt to read his face, his eyes? It's all over. It's all buried. Oh, how wretched I am!"
Alyosha was crying on his knees before her.
"Yes, yes, it's all my fault. It's all my doing,"
he repeated through his sobs.
"No, don't blame yourself, Alyosha. It's other people, our enemies. It's their doing, theirs."
"But excuse me,"
the prince began at last with some impatience.
"What grounds have you for ascribing to me all these crimes? These are all your conjectures. There's no proof of them."
"No proof,"
cried Natasha, rising swiftly from her easy chair.
"You want proof, treacherous man. You could have had no other motive, no other motive when you came here with your project. You had to soothe your son, to appease his conscience pricks, that he might give himself up to Katya with a freer and easier mind. Without that, he would always have remembered me. He would have held out against you, and you have got tired of waiting. Isn't that true?"
"I confess," said the prince with a sarcastic smile, "if I had wanted to deceive you, that would certainly have been my calculation. You are very quick-witted, but you ought to have proofs before you insult people with such reproaches."
"Proofs? But all your behavior in the past, when you were trying to get him away from me. A man who trains his son to disregard such obligations, and to play with them for the sake of worldly advantage, for the sake of money, is corrupting him. What was it you said just now about the staircase and the poorness of my lodging? Didn't you stop the allowance you used to give him to force us to part through poverty and hunger? This lodging and the staircase are your fault, and now you reproach him with it, double-faced man. And what was it roused in you that night such warmth, such new and uncharacteristic convictions? And why was I so necessary to you? I've been walking up and down here for these 4 days. I've thought over everything. I have weighed every word you uttered, every expression of your face, and I'm certain that it has all been a pretense, a sham, a mean, insulting, and unworthy farce. I know you. I've known you for a long time. Whenever Alyosha came from seeing you, I could read from his face all that you had been saying to him, all that you had been impressing on him. No, you can't deceive me. Perhaps you have some other calculations now. Perhaps I haven't said the worst yet. But no matter. You have deceived me. That's the chief thing. I had to tell you that straight to your face."
"Is that all? Is that all the proof you have? But think, you frantic woman, by that farce, as you call my proposal on Tuesday, I bound myself too much. It would be too irresponsible on my part."
"How? How did you bind yourself? What does it mean for you to deceive me? And what does it signify to insult a girl in my position? A wretched runaway, cast off by her father, defenseless, who has disgraced herself, immoral. Is there any need to be squeamish with her if this joke can be of the very smallest use?"
"Only think what a position you are putting yourself into, Natalia Nikolaevna. You insist that you have been insulted by me. But such an insult is so great, so humiliating, that I can't understand how you can even imagine it, much less insist upon it. What must you be accustomed to be able to suppose this so easily, if you will excuse my saying so? I have the right to reproach you, because you are setting my son against me. If he does not attack me now on your account, his heart is against me."
"No, father, no,"
cried Alyosha.
"If I haven't attacked you, it's because I don't believe you could be guilty of such an insult, and I can't believe that such an insult is possible."
"Do you hear?"
cried Prince Valkovsky.
"Natasha, it's all my fault. Don't blame him. It's wicked and horrible. Do you hear, Vanya? He is already against me,"
cried Natasha.
"Enough," said the prince. "We must put an end to this painful scene. This blind and savage outburst of unbridled jealousy shows your character in quite a new light. I am forewarned. We have been in too great a hurry. We certainly have been in too great a hurry. You have not even noticed how you have insulted me. That's nothing to you. We were in too great a hurry. Too great a hurry. My word ought to be sacred, of course, but I am a father, and I desire the happiness of my son."
"You go back from your word,"
cried Natasha, beside herself.
"You are glad of the opportunity. But let me tell you that here, alone, I made up my mind 2 days ago to give him back his promise, and now I repeat it before everyone. I give him up."
"That is, perhaps, you want to reawaken his old anxieties again, his feeling of duty, all this worrying about his obligations, as you expressed it just now yourself, so as to bind him to you again. This is the explanation on your own theory. That is why I say so. But enough time will decide. I will await a calmer moment for an explanation with you. I hope we may not break off all relations. I hope, too, that you may learn to appreciate me better. I meant today to tell you of my projects for your family, which would have shown you. But enough. Ivan Petrovich,
he added, coming up to me,
I have always wanted to know you better, and now, more than ever, I should appreciate it. I hope you understand me. I shall come and see you in a day or two, if you will allow me.
I bowed. It seemed to me, too, that now I could not avoid making his acquaintance. He pressed my hand, bowed to Natasha without a word, and went out with an air of affronted dignity. Chapter 4. For some minutes we all said nothing. Natasha sat in thought, sorrowful and exhausted. All her energy had suddenly left her. She looked straight before her, seeing nothing, holding Alyosha's hand in hers and seeming lost in oblivion. He was quietly giving vent to his grief in tears, looking at her from time to time with timorous curiosity. At last he began timidly trying to comfort her, besought her not to be angry, blamed himself. It was evident that he was very anxious to defend his father, and that this was very much on his mind. He began on the subject several times, but did not dare to speak out, afraid of rousing Natasha's wrath again. He protested his eternal, unchanging love, and hotly justified his devotion to Katya, continually repeating that he only loved Katya as a sister, a dear, kind sister, whom he could not abandon altogether. That would be really coarse and cruel on his part, declaring that if Natasha knew Katya, they would be friends at once, so much so that they would never part and never quarrel. This idea pleased him particularly. The poor fellow was perfectly truthful. He did not understand her apprehensions, and indeed had no clear understanding of what she had just said to his father. All he understood was that they had quarrelled, and that above all lay like a stone on his heart.
"You are blaming me on your father's account?"
asked Natasha.
"How can I blame you?"
he said with bitter feeling,
"when I'm the cause, and it's all my fault. It's I who have driven you into such a fury, and in your anger you blamed him too, because you wanted to defend me. You always stand up for me, and I don't deserve it. You had to fix the blame on someone, so you fixed it on him. And he's really not to blame,"
cried Alyosha, warming up.
"And was it with that thought he came here? Was that what he expected?"
But seeing that Natasha was looking at him with distress and reproach, he was abashed at once.
"Forgive me, I won't,
he said.
"It's all my fault."
"Yes, Alyosha,"
she went on with bitter feeling.
"Now he has come between us and spoilt all our peace, for all our lives. You always believed in me more than in anyone. Now he has poured distrust and suspicion of me into your heart. You blame me. He has already taken from me half your heart. The black cat has run between us."
"Don't speak like that, Natasha. Why do you talk of the black cat?"
He was hurt by the expression.
"He's won you by his false kindness, his false generosity,"
Natasha continued.
"And now he will set you more and more against me."
"I swear that isn't so,"
said Alyosha with still greater heat.
"He was irritated when he said he was in too great a hurry. You will see tomorrow, in a day or two, he'll think better of it. And if he's so angry that he really won't have our marriage, I swear I won't obey him. I shall have the strength, perhaps, for that. And do you know who will help us?"
he cried, delighted with his idea.
"Katya will help us, and you will see what a wonderful creature she is. You will see whether she wants to be your rival and part us. And how unfair you were just now when you said that I was one of those who might change the day after marriage. It was bitter to me to hear that. No, I'm not like that, and if I went often to see Katya..."
"Hush, Alyosha. Go and see her whenever you like. That wasn't what I meant just now. You didn't understand it all. Be happy with anyone you like. I can't ask more of your heart than it can give me."
Mavra came in.
"Am I to bring in the tea? It's no joke to keep the samovar boiling for 2 hours. It's 11 o'clock.
She spoke rudely and crossly. She was evidently out of humour and angry with Natasha. The fact was that ever since Tuesday she had been in the greatest delight that her young lady, whom she was very fond of, was to be married, and had already had time to proclaim it all over the house and neighbourhood, in the shop and to the porter. She had been boasting of it and relating triumphantly that a prince, a man of consequence and a general, awfully rich, had come himself to beg her young lady's consent, and she, Mavra, had heard it with her own ears. And now, suddenly, it had all ended in smoke. The prince had gone away furious, and no tea had been offered to him, and of course it was all her young lady's fault. Mavra had heard her speaking disrespectfully to him.
"Oh, yes,"
answered Natasha.
"And the savouries? Yes, bring them too."
Natasha was confused.
"We've been making such preparations,"
Mavra went on.
"I've been run off my feet ever since yesterday. I ran to the Nevsky for wine, and here..."
And she went out, slamming the door angrily. Natasha reddened and looked at me rather strangely. Meanwhile, tea was served, and with it savouries. There was game, fish of some sort, 2 bottles of excellent wine from Elisiev. What were all these preparations for, I wondered.
"You see what I am, Vanya,"
said Natasha, going up to the table, and she was ashamed even to face me.
"I foresaw it would all end as it has ended, you know. And still I thought that perhaps it wouldn't end so. I thought Alyosha might come and begin to make peace, and we should be reconciled. All my suspicions would turn out to be unjust. I should be convinced, and I got a supper ready on the chance. I thought perhaps we should sit and talk till late."
Poor Natasha. She blushed so deeply as she said this. Alyosha was delighted.
"There, you see, Natasha,"
he cried.
"You didn't believe it yourself. 2 hours ago you didn't believe in your suspicions yourself. Yes, it must all be set right. I'm to blame. It's all my fault, and I'll make it all right. Natasha, let me go straight to my father. I must see him. He is hurt, he is offended. I must comfort him. I will tell him everything, speaking only for myself, only for myself. You shan't be mixed up in it. And I'll settle everything. Don't be angry with me for being so anxious to get to him and ready to leave you. It's not that at all. I'm sorry for him. He will justify himself to you. You will see. Tomorrow I'll be with you as soon as it's light, and I'll spend the whole day with you. I won't go to Katya's."
Natasha did not detain him. She even urged him to go. She was dreadfully afraid that Alyosha would now force himself to stay with her from morning till night, and would weary of her. She only begged him to say nothing in her name, and tried to smile at him more cheerfully at parting. He was just on the point of going, but he suddenly went up to her, took her by both hands, and sat down beside her. He looked at her with indescribable tenderness.
"Natasha, my darling, my angel, don't be angry with me, and don't let us ever quarrel. And give me your word that you'll always believe me, and I will believe you. There, my angel, I'll tell you now. We quarrelled once. I don't remember what about. It was my fault. We wouldn't speak to one another. I didn't want to be the first to beg pardon, and I was awfully miserable. I wandered all over the town, lounged about everywhere, went to see my friends, and my heart was so heavy, so heavy. And then the thought came into my mind, what if you fell ill, for instance, and died? And when I imagined that, I suddenly felt such despair as though I had really lost you for ever. My thoughts grew more and more repressive and terrible. And little by little I began to imagine going to your tomb, falling upon it in despair, embracing it and swooning with anguish. I imagined how I would kiss that tomb and call you out of it, if only for a moment, and pray God for a miracle that for one moment you might rise up before me. I imagined how I would rush to embrace you, press you to me, kiss you, and die, it seemed, with bliss at being able once more for one instant to hold you in my arms as before. And as I was imagining that, the thought suddenly came to me, why, I shall pray to God for 1 minute of you, and meanwhile you have been with me 6 months, and during those 6 months, how many times we've quarrelled, how many days we wouldn't speak to one another. For whole days we've been on bad terms and despised our happiness, and here I'm praying you to come for 1 minute from the tomb, and I'm ready to give my whole life for that minute. When I fancied all that, I couldn't restrain myself, but rushed to you as fast as I could. I ran here, and you were expecting me, and when we embraced after that quarrel, I remember I held you in my arms as tightly as though I were really losing you, Natasha. Don't let us ever quarrel. It always hurts me so. And, good heavens, how could you imagine that I could leave you?"
Natasha was crying. They embraced each other warmly, and Alyosha swore once more that he would never leave her. Then he flew off to his father. He was firmly convinced that he would settle everything, that he would make everything come right.
"It's all ended. It's all over," said Natasha,
pressing my hand convulsively.
"He loves me, and he will never cease to love me. But he loves Katya too, and in a little time he'll love her more than me. And that viper, the prince, will keep his eyes open, and then..."
"Natasha, I too believe that the prince is not acting straightforwardly, but..."
You don't believe all I've said to him. I saw that from your face. But wait a little, you'll see for yourself whether I'm right. I was only speaking generally, but heaven knows what else he has in his mind. He's an awful man. I've been walking up and down this room for the last 4 days, and I see through it all. He had to set Alyosha free to relieve his heart from the burden of sadness that's weighing on his life, from the duty of loving me. He thought of this project of marriage with the idea, too, of worming his way in between us and influencing us, and of captivating Alyosha by his generosity and magnanimity. That's the truth. That's the truth, Vanya. Alyosha's just that sort of character. His mind would be set at rest about me. His uneasiness on my account would be over. He would think, why, she's my wife now, and mine for life, and would unconsciously pay more attention to Katya. The prince has evidently studied Katya, and realizes that she's suited to him, and that she may attract him more than I can. Ach, Vanya, you are my only hope now. He wants for some reason to approach you, to get to know you. Don't oppose this, and for goodness sake, dear, try to find some way of going to the countess's soon. Make friends with this Katya, study her thoroughly, and tell me what she's like. I want to know what you think of her. No one knows me as you do, and you will understand what I want. Find out, too, how far their friendship goes, how much there is between them, what they talk about. It's Katya, Katya, you must observe, chiefly. Show me this once more, dear darling Vanya, show me this once more, what a true friend you are to me. You are my hope, my only hope now.
It was nearly 1 o'clock by the time I got home. Nelly opened the door to me with a sleepy face. She smiled and looked at me brightly. The poor child was very much vexed with herself for having fallen asleep. She had been very anxious to sit up for me. She told me someone had been and inquired for me, had sat and waited for a time, and had left a note on the table for me. The note was from Maslobuev. He asked me to go to him next day between 12 and 1. I wanted to question Nelly, but I put it off till next morning, insisting that she should go to bed at once. The poor child was tired as it was with sitting up for me, and had only fallen asleep 30 minutes before I came in. Chapter 5. In the morning, Nelly told me some rather strange details about the visit of the previous evening. Indeed, the very fact that Maslobuev had taken it into his head to come that evening at all was strange. He knew for a fact that I should not be at home. I had warned him of it myself at our last meeting, and I remembered it distinctly. Nelly told me that at first she had been unwilling to open the door because she was afraid. It was 8 o'clock in the evening. But he persuaded her to do so through the door, assuring her that if he did not leave a note for me that evening, it would be very bad for me next day. When she let him in, he wrote the note at once, went up to her, and sat down beside her on the sofa.
"I got up and didn't want to talk to him," said Nelly. "I was very much afraid of him. He began to talk of Madame Bubnov, telling me how angry she was, that now she wouldn't dare to take me, and began praising you. Said that he was a great friend of yours and had known you as a little boy. Then I began to talk to him. He brought out some sweets and asked me to take some. I didn't want to. Then he began to assure me he was a good-natured man and that he could sing and dance. He jumped up and began dancing. It made me laugh. Then he said he'd stay a little longer. I'll wait for Vanya, maybe he'll come in. And he did his best to persuade me not to be afraid of him, but to sit down beside him. I sat down, but I didn't want to say anything to him. Then he told me he used to know mother and grandfather, and then I began to talk, and he stayed a long time.
What did you talk about?
About mother, Madame Bubnov, grandfather. He stayed 2 hours.
Nelly seemed unwilling to say what they had talked about. I did not question her, hoping to hear it all from Maslobuev. But it struck me that Maslobuev had purposely come when I was out in order to find Nelly alone. What did he do that for, I wondered. She showed me 3 sweetmeats he had given her. They were fruit drops done up in green and red paper, very nasty ones, probably bought at a greengrocer's shop. Nelly laughed as she showed me them. "Why didn't you eat them?" I asked.
"I don't want to,"
she answered seriously, knitting her brows.
"I didn't take them from him. He left them on the sofa himself."
I had to run about a great deal that day. I began saying goodbye to Nelly. "Will you be dull all alone?" I asked her as I went away.
"Dull and not dull. I shall be dull because you won't be here for a long while."
And with what love she looked at me as she said this. She had been looking at me tenderly all that morning, and she seemed so gay, so affectionate, and at the same time there was something shamefaced, even timid in her manner, as though she were afraid of vexing me in some way and losing my affection, and of showing her feelings too strongly, as though she were ashamed of them. "And why aren't you dull, then? You said you were dull and not dull." I could not help asking, smiling to her. She had grown sweet and precious to me.
"I know why,"
she answered, laughing, and for some reason abashed again. We were talking in the open doorway. Nelly was standing before me with her eyes cast down, with one hand on my shoulder and with the other pinching my sleeve. "What is it? A secret?" I asked.
"No, it's nothing. I've begun reading your book while you were away,"
she brought out in a low voice, and turning a tender, penetrating look upon me, she flushed crimson. "Ah, that's it. Well, do you like it?" I felt the embarrassment of an author praised to his face, but I don't know what I would have given to have kissed her at that moment. But it seemed somehow impossible to kiss her. Nelly was silent for a moment.
Why did he die?"
she asked with an expression of the deepest sadness, stealing a glance at me and then dropping her eyes again. "Who?"
"Why, that young man in consumption, in the book."
It couldn't be helped. It had to be so, Nelly.
"It didn't have to at all,"
she answered, hardly above a whisper, but suddenly, abruptly, almost angrily, pouting and staring still more obstinately at the floor. Another minute passed.
"And she, they, the girl and the old man,"
she whispered, still plucking at my sleeve, more hurriedly than before.
"Will they live together? And will they leave off being poor?"
"No, Nelly, she'll go far away. She'll marry a country gentleman, and he'll be left alone," I answered with extreme regret, really sorry that I could not tell her something more comforting.
"Oh, dear, how dreadful. Ugh, what people. I don't want to read it now."
And she pushed away my arm angrily, turned her back on me quickly, walked away to the table, and stood with her face to the corner and her eyes on the ground. She was flushed all over and breathed unsteadily, as though from some terrible disappointment. "Come, Nelly, you're angry," I said, going up to her. "You know it's not true what's written in it. It's all made up. What is there to be angry about? You're such a sensitive little girl."
"I'm not angry,"
she said timidly, looking up at me with clear and loving eyes. Then she suddenly snatched my hand, pressed her face to my breast, and for some reason began crying. But at the same moment she laughed, laughed and cried together. I, too, felt it was funny, and somehow sweet. But nothing would make her lift her head, and when I began pulling her little face away from my shoulder, she pressed it more and more closely against me, and laughed more and more. At last this sentimental scene was over. We parted. I was in a hurry. Nelly, flushed and still seeming as it were shame-faced, with eyes that shone like stars, ran after me out on the stairs, and begged me to come back early. I promised to be sure to be back to dinner, and as early as possible. To begin with, I went to the Ichmenyevs. They were both in. Anna Andreevna was quite ill. Nikolai Sergeyitch was sitting in his study. He heard that I had come, but I knew that, as usual, he would not come out for a quarter of an hour, so as to give us time to talk. I did not want to upset Anna Andreevna too much, and so I softened my account of the previous evening as far as I could, but I told her the truth. To my surprise, though my old friend was disappointed, she was not astonished to hear the possibility of a rupture.
"Well, my dear boy, it's just as I thought," she said. "When you'd gone, I pondered over it, and made up my mind that it wouldn't come to pass. We've not deserved such a blessing. Besides, he's such a mean man. One can't expect anything good to come from him. It shows what he is, that he's taking 10,000 rubles from us for nothing. He knows it's for nothing, but he takes it all the same. He's robbing us of our last crust of bread. Ichmenyevka will be sold, and Natasha's right and sensible not to believe him. But do you know, my dear boy,"
she went on, dropping her voice,
My poor man, he's absolutely against this marriage. He let it out. 'I won't have it,' said he. At first I thought it was only foolishness. No, meant it. What will happen to her then, poor darling? Then he'll curse her utterly. And how about Alyosha? What does he say?"
And she went on questioning me for a long time, and as usual she sighed and moaned over every answer I gave her. Of late, I noticed that she seemed to have quite lost her balance. Every piece of news upset her. Her anxiety over Natasha was ruining her health and her nerves. The old man came in his dressing gown and slippers. He complained of being feverish, but looked fondly at his wife, and all the time that I was there he was looking after her like a nurse, peeping into her face and seeming a little timid with her, in fact. There was a great deal of tenderness in the way he looked at her. He was frightened at her illness. He felt he would be bereaved of everything on earth if he lost her. I sat with them for an hour. When I took leave, he came into the passage with me and began speaking of Nelly. He seriously thought of taking her into his house to fill the place of his daughter, Natasha. He began consulting me how to predispose Anna Andreevna in favor of the plan. With special curiosity, he questioned me about Nelly, asking whether I had found out anything fresh about her. I told him briefly. My story made an impression on him.
"We'll speak of it again," he said decisively. "And meanwhile, but I'll come to you myself as soon as I'm a little better. Then we'll settle things."
At 12 o'clock precisely, I reached Maslobuev's. To my intense amazement, the first person I met when I went in was Prince Valkovsky. He was putting on his overcoat in the entry, and Maslobuev was officiously helping him and handing him his cane. He had already told me that he was acquainted with the prince, but yet this meeting astonished me extremely. Prince Valkovsky seemed confused when he saw me.
"Ah, that's you,"
he cried, with somewhat exaggerated warmth.
"What a meeting, only fancy. But I have just heard from Mr. Maslobuev that he knew you. I'm glad, awfully glad to have met you. I was just wishing to see you, and hoping to call on you as soon as possible. You will allow me? I have a favor to ask of you. Help me explain our present position. You understand, of course, that I'm referring to what happened yesterday. You are an intimate friend. You have followed the whole course of the affair. You have influence. I'm awfully sorry that I can't stay now. Business. But in a few days, and perhaps sooner, I shall have the pleasure of calling on you. But now..."
He shook my hand with exaggerated heartiness, exchanged a glance with Maslobuev, and went away. "Tell me, for mercy's sake," I began as I went into the room.
"I won't tell you anything,"
Maslobuev interrupted, hurriedly snatching up his cap and going towards the entry.
"I've business. I must run too, my boy. I'm late."
"Why, you wrote to me yourself to come at 12 o'clock.
"What if I did write 12 o'clock? I wrote to you yesterday, but today I've been written to myself, and such a piece of business that my head's in a whirl. They're waiting for me. Forgive me, Vanya, the only thing I can suggest to you by way of satisfaction is to punch my head for having troubled you for nothing. If you want satisfaction, punch it. Only, for Christ's sake, make haste. Don't keep me. I've business. I'm late."
"What should I punch your head for? Make haste, then, if you've business. Things unforeseen may happen to anyone. Only..."
"Yes, as for that only, let me tell you,"
he interrupted, dashing out into the entry and putting on his coat. I followed his example.
"I have business with you, too. Very important business. That's why I asked you to come. It directly concerns you and your interests. And as it's impossible to tell you about it in 1 minute now, for goodness sake, promise me to come to me today at 7 o'clock, neither before nor after. I'll be at home."
"Today," I said uncertainly. "Well, old man, I did mean this evening to go..."
"Go at once, dear boy, where you meant to go this evening, and come this evening to me. For you can't imagine, Vanya, the things I have to tell you."
"But I say, what is it? I confess, you make me curious." Meanwhile, we had come out of the gate and were standing on the pavement.
"So you'll come?"
he asked insistently. "I've told you I will."
"No, give me your word of honor."
"Phew, what a fellow. Very well, my word of honor."
"Noble and excellent. Which way are you going?"
"This way," I answered, pointing to the right.
"Well, this is my way,"
said he, pointing to the left.
"Goodbye, Vanya. Remember, 7 o'clock.
Strange, thought I, looking after him. I had meant to be at Natasha's in the evening, but as now I had given my word to Maslobuev, I decided to call on Natasha at once. I felt sure I should find Alyosha there, and as a fact he was there and was greatly delighted when I came in. He was charming, extremely tender with Natasha, and seemed positively to brighten up at my arrival. Though Natasha tried to be cheerful, it was obviously an effort. Her face looked pale and ill, and she had slept badly. To Alyosha, she showed an exaggerated tenderness. Though Alyosha said a great deal and told her all sorts of things, evidently trying to cheer her up and to bring a smile to her lips, which seemed set in unsmiling gravity, he obviously avoided speaking of Katya or of his father. Evidently, his efforts at reconciliation had not succeeded.
"Do you know what? He wants dreadfully to get away from me,"
Natasha whispered to me hurriedly when he went out for a minute to give some order to Mavra.
"But he's afraid, and I'm afraid to tell him to go myself, for then perhaps he'll stay on purpose. But what I'm most afraid of is his being bored with me and getting altogether cold to me through that. What am I to do?"
"Good heavens, what a position you've put yourselves in! And how suspicious, how watchful you are of one another. Simply explain to him and have done with it. Why, he may well be weary of such a position."
"What's to be done?"
she cried, panic-stricken. "Wait a minute. I'll arrange it all for you." And I went into the kitchen on the pretext of asking Mavra to clean one of my overshoes, which was covered with mud.
"Be careful, Vanya,"
she cried after me. As soon as I went out to Mavra, Alyosha flew up to me as though he had been waiting for me.
"Ivan Petrovich, my dear fellow, what am I to do? Do advise me. I promised yesterday to be at Katya's just at this time today. I can't avoid going. I love Natasha beyond expression. I would go through the fire for her, but you'll admit that I can't throw up everything over there."
"Well, go then."
"But what about Natasha? I shall grieve her, you know, Ivan Petrovich. Do get me out of it somehow."
"I think you'd much better go. You know how she loves you. She will be thinking all the while that you are bored with her and staying with her against your will. It's better to be more unconstrained. Come along, though. I'll help you."
"Dear Ivan Petrovich, how kind you are."
We went back. A minute later, I said to him, "I saw your father just now."
"Where?"
he cried, frightened. "In the street, by chance." He stopped to speak to me a minute and asked again to become better acquainted with me. He was asking about you, whether I knew where you were now. He was very anxious to see you, to tell you something.
"Oh, Alyosha, you'd better go and show yourself,"
Natasha put in, understanding what I was leading up to.
"But where shall I meet him now? Is he at home?"
"No, I remember he said he was going to the Countess's."
"What shall I do then?"
Alyosha asked naively, looking mournfully at Natasha.
"Why, Alyosha, what's wrong?"
she said.
"Do you really mean to give up that acquaintance to set my mind at rest? Why, that's childish. To begin with, it's impossible, and secondly, it would be ungrateful to Katya. You are friends. It's impossible to break off relations so rudely. You'll offend me at last if you think I'm so jealous. Go at once, go, I beg you, and satisfy your father."
"Natasha, you're an angel, and I'm not worth your little finger,"
cried Alyosha rapturously and remorsefully.
"You are so kind. Well, well, let me tell you, I've just been asking Ivan Petrovich out there in the kitchen to help me to get away. And this was his plan. But don't be hard on me, Natasha, my angel. I'm not altogether to blame, for I love you 1,000 times more than anything on earth, and so I've made a new plan, to tell Katya everything, and describe to her our present position, and all that happened here yesterday. She'll think of something to save us. She's devoted to us heart and soul."
"Well, go along,"
said Natasha, smiling.
"And I tell you what, I'm very anxious to make Katya's acquaintance myself. How can we arrange it?"
Alyosha's enthusiasm was beyond all bounds. He began at once making plans for bringing about a meeting. To his mind, it was very simple. Katya would find a way. He enlarged on his idea warmly, excitedly. He promised to bring an answer that day, within a couple of hours, and to spend the evening with Natasha.
"Will you really come?"
asked Natasha as she let him out.
"Can you doubt it? Goodbye, Natasha. Goodbye, my darling, my beloved, forever. Goodbye, Vanya. Ach, I called you Vanya by mistake. Listen, Ivan Petrovich, I love you. Let me call you Vanya. Let's drop formality."
"Yes, let us."
"Thank goodness. It's been in my mind 100 times, but I've never somehow dared to speak of it. Ivan Petrovich, there, I've done it again. You know, it's so difficult to say Vanya all at once. I think that's been described somewhere by Tolstoy. Two people promise to call each other by their pet names, but they can't do it and keep avoiding using any name at all. Ach, Natasha, do let's read over childhood and boyhood together. It is so fine."
"Come, be off, be off."
Natasha drove him away, laughing.
"He's babbling with delight."
"Goodbye. In 2 hours' time I shall be with you."
He kissed her hand and hastened away.
"You see, Vanya,"
said she, and melted into tears. I stayed with her for about 2 hours, tried to comfort her, and succeeded in reassuring her. Of course, she was right about everything, in all her apprehensions. My heart was wrung with anguish when I thought of her present position. I was afraid, but what could I do? Alyosha seemed strange to me, too. He loved her no less than before. Perhaps, indeed, his feeling was stronger, more poignant than ever, from remorse and gratitude. But at the same time, his new passion was taking a strong hold on his heart. It was impossible to see how it would end. I felt very inquisitive to see Katya. I promised Natasha again that I would make her acquaintance. Natasha seemed to be almost cheerful at last. Among other things, I told her all about Nelly, about Maslobuev and Madame Bubnov, about my meeting Prince Valkovsky that morning at Maslobuev's, and the appointment I had made with the latter at 7 o'clock. All this interested her extremely. I talked a little about her parents, but I said nothing for the present about her father's visit to me. His project of a duel with the prince might have frightened her. She, too, thought it very strange that the prince should have anything to do with Maslobuev, and that he should display such a great desire to make friends with me, though this could be to some extent explained by the position of affairs. At 3 o'clock I returned home. Nelly met me with her bright little face. Chapter 6. At 7 o'clock, punctually, I was at Maslobuev's. He greeted me with loud exclamations and open arms. He was, of course, half drunk. But what struck me most was the extraordinary preparation that had been made for my visit. It was evident that I was expected.